largely useless. Thanagy really came from, more to the body than to him, you said. A planet's a ball of dust. Its thanagy comes from the accumulation of microbial life. You can't consider it one coherent system.
Call it a communal soul, said her emperor. What's a human being other than a sack of microbial life? You're a bone adept, aren't you? Flesh magicians are exposed to this idea of a system earlier than in your school. This was kindly, even humorously said, but you still found that you immediately wanted to be tossed out the airlock at the idea that your aptitude made you less than a flesh magician, someone whose entire education was in the carnal. Experts in things that were yellow and wobbled, people who thought there was something really interesting to be found in meat. He mistook your deeply bigoted hate for disbelief and said, just accept the proposition for now that a planet has an enormous single amount of thanagy. If this thanagy is converted, what might happen during that transition?
We already know what happens, you said. Your tongue was growing thick in your mouth, and your eyelids were sore and swollen from wanting to close. The first rush of adrenaline had run its course. The body came and took your wrist in her hand and ringed her fingers around your bones quite tightly. This let you say, the cohort prepares a planet for necromancy every time they have to breach it. Over time, with the introduction of thanagetic decay, the planet converts. Necromancy proceeds as normal afterward. Nothing happens. Plant and animal life both change, of course, and eventually the planet flips totally, and the population has to be moved. But that's such a long-term process that it takes generations. You can't quantify it as something happening.
Now kill the planet all at once, said her emperor. What then?
You looked at him. The emperor of the Nine Houses raised his hands, palms up, as though offering a hopeless prayer to the roof of the cargo hold. His alien eyes were cool and calm. You knew of only one mass dying off of planets. So you said, you tell me, Lord. You were there for the resurrection.
Yes, he said, and I saw the thanagy convert immediately. The difference between dying of illness and dying from murder, an enormous shock, the immediate expulsion of the soul. And just as when a soul is ripped untimely from a human being, when a soul is so rudely taken from a planet, sweat came to the centres of your palms totally unbidden. A trickle of blood started down your leg, and you stopped it in mid-flow, dried it to flakes on your skin and clotted the breach. Such an act took no effort now.
A revenant, you said.
Always a revenant, he said. Every single time a goddamned revenant. Pardon the pun.
You fancied you could see the body breathing, her chest rising very slightly in and out. The emperor crossed his arms and stared across the cargo hold, his face lit from beneath by electric lighting, the gleam in his eyes black and wet. You caught him moistening his lips with the tip of his tongue.
We call them resurrection beasts, he said.
It took him another moment to continue, and when he did, it was with the air of a man telling a very old story.
When the system died, when I was younger, those 10,000 years ago, and I brought us back from that brink, all those revenants scuttled off to the farthest parts of the universe, as the soul runs from its corpse in the blind first fear of transition. I have never seen a planet make another in the same way. I've seen lesser monsters, minor beasts, but nothing. Nothing like that first wave.
Harrowhark,
Those revenants move through the universe inexorably, without pause, and they feed on phallogenic planets as they go, like vampires. And they won't stop until I and the Nine Houses are dead. They have had me on the run for a myriad, and they're nearly impossible to take down.
This made very little impact on you. It had the dim and nonsensical ring of a fairy story. You said, "The Lictors have died fighting these things."
"Fighting them," said God. "Harrow, I've lost half my Lictors distracting them. They're hideously complex to destroy. The ones we killed through luck. They were young, and we were at full power. And then, once our numbers thinned out, by sheer accident or by suicide mission."
"How many revenants are there?"
You prepared for an astronomical number. The body raised its eyebrows when the Emperor Undying said,
"3.
"There were 9. We called them by number. Over 10,000 years, we have managed to take out a grand total of 5. Number 2 fell soon after the resurrection. Number 8 cost a man's immortal soul. And I still see that day in my dreams. Number 6 died because one of my hands, Cyrus, drew it into an ultramassive black hole. And number 6 had better be dead, because Cyrus won't be coming back."
Before you could do anything, exclaim or question his mathematics, which did not hold up even on first acquaintance, he did something dreadful. The Emperor of the Nine Houses pushed himself away from the plain coffin with the rose, and he stood before you at the thirds, with his monstrous eyes and his ordinary face, and he took both of your hands in his. He patted them gently, as though you were a child whose pet had been squashed in a tragic accident. It would have been preferable for him to rip your ribs from their costal cartilage and waggle them around. It would have been preferable for him to take your throat beneath his hands and snap your neck. There were bright lights in your vision. You were deeply distressed.
"The choice I offered you was always a false one," he said. "I'm sorry. The resurrection beasts always know where I am, and wherever I am, they turn themselves to me and start moving, slowly, but never stopping. And they don't turn to me alone, though they focus on me most strongly. They hunt whoever has committed the indelible sin."
You stared at him. He dropped his hands. You said,
"Which indelible sin?" "The one you committed when you became a Lictor," said the Emperor.
You heard dimly the doors of Dreaber close. You perceived the grind of their mechanism and their indelible clang, the echo of their shutting ringing throughout the bottom atrium and upward into the tunnel shaft. Then your memories of it muddied and disappeared, back with the rest of your unsorted collection.
"They will be coming for me," you said. And you said the words only because you thought you ought to make them come true. "If I returned to my house, they would follow me there."
He said,
"No Lictor has ever returned home once we understood the repercussions. No Lictor except one, who knew I would come to intercept her for that very reason."
You looked at her plain coffin again. It was not particularly large. The body it held was not tall or broad, nor imposing nor grand. You found yourself saying distantly,
"And so the intention is to teach me how to fight these things?"
"Not before I teach you how to run," said the Emperor. "It's a rough lesson to learn. It's never complete. But I've been running for 10,000 years, so I will be your teacher."
After a moment, he laid his hands on your shoulders, and you found yourself looking up into his weird and ordinary face.
"What he is saying," said the body distinctly, "is that you have to learn that sword."
You looked at her, over his shoulder. The Emperor instinctively followed your gaze, but he could never have seen what you saw. The wheels, where the chains had passed around the other girl's wrists, neck, ankles. He would not perceive that long hair hanging wetly over her shoulders, that resinous colour that in death might have been brown, or might have been gold, or might have been anything. He could not have heard the voice, low, husky, musical, or its dry and uncanny echo of other voices you had known. Your mother's. Crux's. He would not know that, in truth, the body of the locked tomb had not spoken to you since the night you massaged the purple, swollen clots of blood out of the necks of your dead parents, so that their strangulation might not be so obvious. He would not know that you had only walked with her one tranquil year, and trysted with her afterward only in your dreams. He could not possibly know that in your youth her eyes had often been black, like yours were, but that ever since you had writhed in literal agony, her eyes had turned a yellow that made you dizzy to behold, a bronzed, hot, animal yellow, as amber as the inside of an egg. When you were 10 years old, the body was quiet and rigorous, practical and merciful. At 14, the body was tender and serene, and sometimes smiled. When you were 16, the body was resolute and impassioned. In all these incarnations, she had preserved her vow of silence. Now the sound of her voice meant the madness had returned to you in full.
"I can't," you said, as carefully as possible. "I can't, beloved. It's gone."
The Emperor said, "Harrow?" But you'd mostly forgotten he was there.
"You are walking down a long passage," said the body. "You need to turn around."
"I am standing in the dark," you told her. Each of the body's eyelashes was wet with frost.
"I lost it. It's gone. There's nothing there. I must have misapprehended the process. I am half a lictor. I am nothing. I am pointless. I am unmanned."
Hands fell heavy on your shoulders. You looked from the face you loved to the face of the resurrecting king.
"Ortus Nigenad did not die for nothing," he said.
As he spoke, his mouth looked strange. A hot whistle of pain ran down your temporal bone. Your body was numb to grief. Perhaps you had felt it once, but you did not feel it any more.
"Ortus Nigenad died thinking it was the only gift he was capable of giving," you said.
"And I have wasted it, like air."
The resurrecting king took on the expression of a man working out a very difficult and emotionally taxing anagram.
He said, "Ortus," again,
but the bile was sputtering up into your throat, your mouth, before the body passed her hand over your eyebrows and the bridge of your nose, and you slipped from his imperial grip. You fell almost senseless to the floor.
"Ortus Nigenad," said the Emperor again, almost wondering.
But then you knew nothing more, except that you hadn't thrown up on God, which had to count as consolation.
Chapter 3. The Reverend Daughter, Herohark Nona Jesimus, ought to have been the 311th Reverend Mother of her line. She was the 87th Nona of her house. She was the first Harrowhark. She was named for her father, who was named for his mother, who was named for some unsmiling extramural penitent sworn into the silent marriage bed of the locked tomb. This had been common. Driba had never practiced resurrection purity. Their only aim was to keep the necromantic lineage of the tomb keepers unbroken. Now all its remnant blood was Harrow. She was the last necromancer, and the last of her line left alive.
Her birth had been expensive. 18 years ago, in order to wrench a final bud from this terminal axle, her mother and father had slaughtered all the children of their house in order to secure a necromantic heir. Harrow had been created in that hour of pallor mortis, while the souls of her peers were fumbling to escape their bodies, her genesis their ignition of thanagy, as they died with a simultaneity her parents had agonized to calculate. None of this had been kept from her. It had been explained to Harrow year after year, right from the time she knew both when to speak and when to not. This skill came early to Ninth House infants. As a child, she was allowed to pull down the coverlet and get into bed only after she had worked her way through 45 minutes of evening prayers, bracketed by her wretched great-aunts Lacrimorta and Isamorta. They had been strict with her infant catechism, and their presence was a strong motivation for Harrow to get her prayers exactly right and not start over, as they smelled like incense and tooth decay. She had enunciated clearly, no lisping, devotions of their own devising.
"The tomb I will serve till the end of my days, and then see me buried in 200 graves,
which they'd thought sweetly whimsical. Just right for a little girl. Otherwise, Harrowhark was left completely to her own devices. She would rise well before first bell and pray in the chapel before they turned on the heating, her fingers much too cold to count her prayer beads, and then she would ensconce herself in one of the libraries with a battery lantern and a blanket and her books. She embarked on her study of necromancy alone. The dead were her mentors and tutors. Harrow had no idea how difficult it was to understand the work of adult necromancers, which meant she did not fear trying to understand it. Her development suffered from neither ego nor apprehension. Her parents would sometimes have her recite her theorems of an evening, or make her conjure ulna bones from a skeleton ground up to powder, or they would have their elderly marshal, Crux, heave some recent corpse over the top tier to squash right to the bottom and have her fuse the bones back together blind, through the dermis and meat. Then they would open up the body to see how well or badly she had done, but either way their approval was mostly relief. In her genius, they had received the goods that they had so dearly paid for. Crux told her that her parents had been different once. This must have been before they committed a little light child massacre. Harrow had been dimly interested in this factoid. She could never recall her parents being anything but exhausted, their joy all spent. Her mother rarely spoke, or if she did, addressed all her remarks to their hulking cavalier, a man who looked as though he would weep if he could only figure out how. Her most vivid memory of her mother was of her hands guiding Harrow's over an inexpertly rendered portion of skull, her fingers encircling the fat baby bracelets of Harrow's wrists, tightening this cuff to indicate correct technique. Her father had been the more voluble of the two. In the evenings, he read to his little family, sometimes sermons, and sometimes antique family letters. That was another rare memory. The electric light strung up behind her father's chair, her sat on a three-legged stool next to her mother, her father's voice a drone unceasing, until a touch from his cavalier indicated that he might stop. Harrow would shrug herself inside her black hooded church robe and practice moulding tiny motes of bone between her finger and thumb, pressing them into soft fingerprints, mentally chopping her body into 200 relic pieces.
Then everything changed, abruptly, forever.
Harrowhark fell in love.
Falling was not the right term, precisely. It was a long process. She more correctly climbed down into love, picked its locks, opened its gates, and breached its inner chamber. Her life had been dedicated to the locked tomb, and what was interred within had commanded her whole attention since she understood what it was. The comatose corpse that lay in state amid the tatters of the ninth house. She'd been taught to love the Emperor, who 10,000 years ago had given them all release from a death that none of them had deserved, and to view the tomb as symbol of his victory and his demise. Her mother and father feared what lay consigned to that locked-up grave. Her tedious great-aunts worshipped it, but in desperation, as though their collective awe might flatter it into sparing God. They had never wanted to open the doors and look upon it. Those doors had opened for the body to be brought in, and they would only open again for the body to come out, in some doom yet to come. Harrow was forbidden entry in the same way she was forbidden from going up to the top tier of the drill shaft and taking a hammer to the oxygen sealant machines. It would be the end. Most of her life was spent in silence. There were many moments when she found living difficult, tedious. On the worst days, fatuous. Memory now recalled what had happened very bloodlessly, and the details were unimportant. One very bad day, when it seemed as though everyone hated her, and as though this were a completely correct way to feel, with bloodied fists and a bruised heart, she wrote a note explaining her suicide, then went and unlocked the door. Unexpectedly, this did not kill her. And what did not kill her made her curious. She was much older before she could cross the threshold. It was trapped like all hell. But the traps were ninth traps, made of bone and grinning skeleton, and she'd been using them herself since she was toddling. In the end, the experience was merely educational. She crossed the cave, which was trapped, and passed the central moat of black water, which was deep and trapped, and then climbed the island, trapped, to the frozen mausoleum, ridiculously trapped. And when she got there, alive, she could look into the open-faced coffin where lay the reason for her existence. God's victory and death was a girl, maybe a woman. At the time, Harrowhark had not known how to tell, and the gender was only a self-interested guess. The corpse lay packed in ice, wearing a white shift, her hands clasping a frost-rimed sword, and she was beautiful. The formation of her muscles was perfect. Each limb was a carved representation of a perfect limb, each bloodless foot the lifeless and high-arched simulacrum of the perfect foot. Each black and frosted lash lay against the cheeks with perfect still blackness, and her nose. It was the pinnacle of what a nose should be. None of this would have broken Harrow's spirit, except that the mouth alone was perfectly imperfect, a little crooked, with a divot in the lower lip as though someone had softly pressed a dent into the bow with the tip of their finger. Harrow, who had been born for the sole privilege of worshipping this corpse, loved it wildly from sight. So the death of God had been Harrow's death too. She had been careless with her visits. Her parents had found out about what she had done, what manner of sin she had committed, and they reacted just as they might have if she had admitted to smashing up the oxygen sealant machine with a hammer. Faced with apocalypse, they chose to die by their own hands before another death could claim them. They weren't even angry. It was with a calm and earnest understanding that her mother and father and their cavalier tied 5 nooses, 1 for mother, 1 for father, 2 for Mortis, 1 for her. Then they hanged themselves with barely a gasp and barely a kick. It would have been better, really, if Harrow had hanged herself up beside them. It would have been best if she had crawled into the tomb beside the woman she loved and let the freezing temperatures take their course. But Harrow, who was 200 dead children, Harrow, who loved something that had not been alive for 10,000 years, Harrow Hark, Nona Jesimus, had always so badly wanted to live. She had cost too much to die. Love had broken her life into 2 separate halves, the half before she had fallen, and the half afterward. Afterward, she hated to sit in the apse during chant and listen to a weird thuddering beat disrupt the prayers of the faithful, a distance striking at the back of her head that she had taken for someone being out of time. She heard doors open and close in distant halls where no doors were opening or closing. Her body would become very frightened and her brain very frustrated. In her agonies, she would have to sit right beside her aging Marshal Crux, usually while being spoon-fed. He was insistent that she had to eat. And all the while she would demand, "Is that real?" for half of what she heard, and he could say, "Yes, my lady," or "No, my lady," and she might be content. It killed all her peace. Even in the long dark days she spent wholly alone, in the libraries or in her laboratory, fingers burnt from handling fatty ashes, she would hear voices just out of her hearing, or see things in her periphery that were not there. It seemed to her that sometimes her hands would grasp her own throat and press up against her windpipe until she saw spots in her vision. She would see dangling ropes. She would forget where she was and wipe out a whole morning scholarship with false memory. In that first year after her parents' deaths, she often saw the body, when she was sleeping or when she was waking, and that was relief and frustration both. The body brought her total peace, but in its presence she lost track of time. She would sit with her hand very close to the dry, dead hand of her obsession, and when she looked up the hours would be eaten away, or she would check the time and be astonished and discombobulated that it had been only a few minutes. When her pituitary gland kicked in, the body stopped appearing when she was awake, but the other hallucinations kept on. Harrow was furious that she was doing something so pedestrian as to pubesce. But as puberty changed her yet again, with hormones or time or both, she was able to regain some semblance of control over her maggot-eaten mind. She prayed often. Her brain took refuge in rituals. Sometimes she fasted, or ate the same thing for every meal, arranged in a specific pattern on her plate, consumed in the same order for months on end. She wore her paint far beyond the strictures of any nun, wore it in private, sometimes slept in it. She found the sight of her own unpainted face in the mirror impossibly wearisome, monstrous and nonsensical, somehow far away and yet heinously attached to herself. Harrow did not often weep, but at times she sat within the shroud of her cot and rocked back and forth with hard, fast motions, often for hours. The scholarship grew difficult once she realized belatedly that it was difficult. But that was cured by working harder. She spent sometimes half a month on the same theorem. She moved her mother and father through the house like chess pieces, trying every year to correct their stiff and unnatural gait, sitting them in chapel as her people asked them for guidance she had little idea how to give. But the penitents and devoted of the locked tomb were getting old, and she learned that they all wanted to be told the same thing. More often than not, she would stand between her parents' corpses at some deathbed, watching one more of her penitents rattle their last as she repeated the words of their final service. They died happy. They loved it. She had a real talent. Harrowhark had attended so many deathbeds and given so many solemn takes about death and duty that in the end she started to believe them. The ninth house elderly became the ninth house decrepit, and the ninth house decrepit became the ninth house dead. Harrowhark was by most of them when they died, except if they had a sudden pulmonary, and even at 14 she was good enough with a heart arrest to keep them going until she could give them final rites. She'd always disdained flesh magic, but she had a knack for the aorta. Later, when their meat had trickled away, she personally raised their defleshed skeletons to work the mangle or quietly rake the snow-leek fields in the upper reaches of Dreaba. Much of her necromancy had been sharpened by the day-to-day busy work of geriatric death, of the niche and the skull, of sitting with osteoporotic bones and filling up their honeycomb so that the constructs did not end up a confusion of rib cages with their legs powdering off. Her parents knew what they had been about, making a genius out of 200 dead children. It took a genius simply to keep the house from deliquescing into a pile of bones and pneumonia victims. But even a genius could only maintain the status quo. The house had never had the tech, nor the understanding, nor the on-duty flesh magicians to work a vat womb. The womb-bearing populace was too old to have babies, barring two of their number, one of whom was herself. Harrow could only thank God that duty had never fallen to her. The only viable source of healthy XY had been located in her house's Cavalier Primary, a boy 17 years her elder. Back then, she had considered him a walk-around mansuit surrounding some quite good calcium carbonate, and she knew he considered her with an awful respect, the same type one might have for a hereditary cancer that one knew was on its way. Thankfully, their marriage would have mingled the Dreaber Cavalier and Scion lines beyond any hope of repair. Ortis Nigenad was an only child. Harrowhark had her parents quashed the idea so enthusiastically that she cracked her father's molar. The only virgin who could possibly be more relieved was Ortis himself. So the years passed, unshriven, crusting up and drying as they went. Harrowhark watched Crux get older and older and older, and tried all the tricks in her box to keep him upright. There was terrible plaque in his arteries, and he pretended that he did not notice her scraping them. She knew that when she finally laid her nursemaid in his niche, it would be the death of the only other person invested in her sanity. And if she went mad again, then what? At any point, she could have asked for assistance from her sister houses. At any point, she could have asked for cohort intervention, and they would have been there the next day with fetal care boxes and volunteer penitents and loans and plant samples, and with incontrovertible suggestions that Harrowhark really ought to marry this son of the second or this daughter of the fifth. And she could have watched coloured banners get strung up next to the black skull of the black anchorite, and that would be the end of the ninth house, even more completely than a hammer to the oxygen sealant machine. They needed a resurrection. They needed a miracle. Harrowhark had been studying miracles for years, and then one landed squarely in her lap, the chance to become a lictor. the chance to serve the Emperor, her god, the chance to become a fist and a gesture, the chance to become an immortal servitor and advocate for Dreaba, to refresh the ninth house on her terms, with the rock never rolled away and the love of her life and her death quiet and unmolested in her deadly shrine of stone. Another 10,000 years of solitude. Another long and snaking line of reverend mothers, reverend fathers. Harrow took the unready cavalier from her house, and she snatched the chance with both hands. But like falling in love the first time, becoming a lictor had all gone wrong. Her cavalier had given himself to her with a numb readiness that still burnt her to ash with shame. Even with that readiness, she had committed the indelible sin halfway. She had gathered up the matter of Ortus Nigenad's soul and not been able to choke him all the way down. She was Harrowhark alone in front of the mirror again. A nonsense. A monster. An alien geometry. A loathsome squawk of a person. She was 9 and she'd made a mistake. She was 17 and she'd made a mistake. Time had repeated itself. Harrow would be tripping over herself for her whole existence, a frictionless hoop of totally fucking up. There had been another girl who grew up alongside Harrow, but she had died before Harrow was born.
Chapter 4.
You still prided yourself on 3 things. Firstly, bloody-minded composure. Secondly, an inhuman intellect for necromancy. Thirdly, being very difficult to kill. You were so immune to murder that you had not even been able to inflict the act upon yourself. When you woke up midway through the first attempt on your life, your mind startled itself out of its thick fog and shook itself awake. There was a soft, all-encompassing warmth pressing over your face that could only have been your pillow, the thin cloth cover damp with your spit and breath. Someone was standing to the right of your cot and holding the pillow down. As you reflexively bucked, one hand moved to put hard pressure on your throat, and your hyoid would have cracked had you not reinforced it with a thick rime of cartilage. They were a damned fool for not getting atop you. You found your fingers and plucked the thumbnail from your left hand, screaming into that asphyxiating white darkness, and separated your bloody disc of keratin and flesh into 1,000 racine fragments, then expanded those into a multitude of jagged, splintering flechettes. Blind, airless, you swung these stiff and hairy missiles into your assailant like so much shrapnel. You heard them thud into flesh and ping off the wall and bury themselves in steel. Good. Good. The weight on the pillow lightened and... You came to on your bare, beer-like cot all at once, hyperventilating. The pillow behind your head was perfectly dry. You held your left hand up before your face, before the light, the even white light with its hot tungsten filaments. The thumbnail was whole and even. Too even? Were you wont to chew your fingernails still, that unattractive tick of your girlhood? The great two-hander lay next to you like an undisturbed baby, and across the wall of your quarters. Nothing. No nail fragments. No scarring on the wall, just a neat stack of crates. And in a chair, dragged close to your bedside, the little chair that usually sat by the door, the one you had only ever seen the Emperor occupy, was Ianthe Tridentarius. Your gazes met. The other nascent lictor, the third house saint, the Emperor's bones and the Emperor's joints, the Emperor's fists and gestures, was clothed in a beautiful nacreous robe that glimmered all the colours of the rainbow, gauzy, iridescent white stuff that changed violently in the light. The mother of pearl made Ianthe's hair a lurid yellow, and threw up all the mustard tints of her skin. Her face was blotchy, and her eyes were sleepless pits. She looked like shit. You noticed that the eyes were a curious muddle of colours, washed-out purple jostled for space with a milky blue, freckled here and there with a lightish, hazy brown. Ianthe was sitting significantly too near to you, and she had arranged herself in the chair in a strangely lopsided, tilt-shouldered fashion. She also possessed two arms, which was one more than you'd last seen her sporting. None of that particularly bothered you. What bothered you was that now the Princess of Ida, pale-haired, all height and elbows, twilight shadows beneath her eyes, was looking at you with an expression you struggled to remember ever seeing on her face. Ianthe was fond of languid attitudes and postures. She affected a heavy, artificial tedium, or a faint and glittering malice, sometimes even a self-deprecating and idle humorousness. But she looked at you now with a soft and thoroughly uncharacteristic hunger. She smiled down at you with a frank, over-familiar indulgence that frightened you. Ianthe looked lit from within. "Good morning, my comrade," she said. "My colleague, my ally. I do like your eyes, Harrowhawk. Like flower petals in a darkened room. And even I can admit that your eyelashes are delicious. Stop wearing that pillowcase any time you like. I've seen your face before, and I know it looks like both of your parents were right-angled triangles. We must work with what we've got, as the flesh magician said to the leper." Your whole soul flinched. A livid heat rose up your neck. With a titanic struggle, you managed not to shield your face with your hands, to be sure of your bedsheet mask. Literal perception had made you complacent. Ianthe Tridentarius was a black hole where no heart could be sensed beating, and no brain could be seen sparking. The brain, you knew grudgingly, existed. The heart was an open question. She looked at your face, saw most likely her own death reflected in your expression, and reached inside her robe. The palm of your hand slapped to her forehead with a ringing thwack. You could not sense her. She was a locked door in a dark room to you. But with a touch, you could feel the orbital bones you might remove from her face. "Before you do anything, I am quick to reassure you that you will regret," said the other lictor, who had not moved, who had not recoiled at your palm's promise, except, perhaps, a quick shuttering of those mixed-up eyes. "I have a message for you." The hand slowly withdrew from the robe. None of this would have been enough, except the blood howled in your ears. You thought you heard footsteps, but then they slurred into voices, then back into footsteps again. That caught between Ianthe's fingers was a piece of flimsy, with the name Harrowhark clearly upon it. The name Harrowhark was lettered in your hand. Underneath, in smaller lettering, and still your hand, "To be given to Harrowhark immediately upon coherence." You looked at the letter. You looked at Ianthe. Even in that short interval, the battlefield of her eyes had changed. From beneath your palm, you could see that one iris was now wholly a washed-out purple, like a fading bruise or a dying flower. The other one was blue and brown commingled. This glittering mess of heterochromatics focused on you, totally calm, utterly sure of itself. "I wish you'd explained to me what coherence meant," she complained. "Did you mean coherent as in I recognize objects and their names? Did you mean coherent as in I am no longer remotely out to lunch, which means you're still not eligible? I wasn't going anywhere near you in the first instance of you opening your eyes. Your only settings were power vomit and murder. Tell me how you came to have what you are holding," you croaked. You put it in my own hands, you skull-faced fruitcake, she said soothingly. Go on, take it. It's yours. You withdrew your hand from her forehead and you took it. You were desperately afraid that your fingers were shaking and that you would not know to make them stop. In your lap, under the strong white light of the hospital quarter, you could see no error or artifice in the writing. It was yours, not an exceptional copy. It was written in your blood. When you touched the smooth, plex-rendered surface, you could see in your mind's eye the pen nib, the soft bite of the metal into the inside of your lip. Unfolding the flimsy and spreading it across your knees was the final gobbet boiling off the skeleton. The letter was written in Ninth House crypt script, your own cipher, based off that of your parents and developed when you were 7 years old. It was unbreakable to anyone who lacked your rosary, Marshal Crux, and 100 or so years to spare. You read, addressing the Reverend Lady Harrowhark Nona Jesimus, known as the Reverend Daughter by her own desire, now Harrowhark the First, writing as the same, now dead. I'll give you a moment, said Ianthe, and she stood and crossed over to the window, standing bathed in the light of the nearest star. Addressing the Reverend Lady Harrowhark Nona Jesimus, known as the Reverend Daughter by her own desire, now Harrowhark the First, writing as the same, now dead. Letter number 2 of 24, to be read immediately on coherence. Harrowhark, as I write, it has been 48 hours since you became a lictor at Canaan House. By the time you read this, you will not recall the writing thereof, as the Harrowhark of the writing will be dead and gone. Her resurrection constitutes a fail-state, and must be avoided at all costs. This letter cannot answer questions. What I have done, I will refer to as the work, and its character is actively harmful for you to know. I will instead provide guidelines on how to live the rest of your life. As your life may hopefully now extend into the myriads, it is of enormous import that you are not tempted to deviate from them. You are the living surety of promises I have made. Break troth with me, and from beyond my destruction I will brand you tomb heretic, cut off utterly from that which lies on the frozen altar, asleep and dead, removed from the adoration thereof, and any promise of part in her resurrection. Guideline number 1. Stay alive. You may not end your own life through suicide. You may not end your own life through carelessness. Accidental death must be avoided at all costs and never accepted as an outcome. The work relies upon your continuance. Guideline number 2. You can never return to the Ninth House. The way home is closed to you. Do not set foot within the house again. Do not allow yourself to be taken there by force. Guideline number 3. The sword will remain on you at all times. Wipe it down with your arterial blood nightly. Coat the blade in the ash which regrows. Do not cut flesh with the naked blade. Do not cut bone with the naked blade. Even this may not prove enough. Treat the sword as your promised death and act according to the first guideline. Guideline number 4. You are compromised. You may already suspect this, if you're not as big a fool as I take you for. I will confirm your access to the lictoral well. This battery is most likely the extent of your capability. Make up for your inevitable failings through study. Your understanding of flesh and spirit magic is execrable, so start there. Do not aim to only build upon what you already know. It pains me to admit this, but you know piss all. I refuse to let you build your house on such shiftless and urial sand. Guideline number 5. You owe Ianthe Tridentarius the favour of the chain.
This will be difficult to justify. I will therefore not justify it. Tridentarius has made what has come to pass possible. I owe her a debt that you will undoubtedly be paying for the rest of your life. The agreement does end on your death. The agreement does extend into the house, but not into the tomb. The agreement is singular, but does take precedence over and above any debt you have sworn to anyone lesser than the Holy Corpse, over and above the Emperor of the Nine Houses. In order to avoid philosophical quandaries, she will expect you to re-swear immediately on receipt of the letter, and any failure to do so undoes the whole business. Do not be tardy here. It goes without saying that Ianthe will destroy you if she can. She has helped me ably, but it has cost her nothing and you everything. I have guarded from her full understanding of the work so that she cannot undo it on a whim or by accident. You are in her power. I am in no doubt of her misusing it. You yourself never had power over anyone else, but you misused it violently.
Guideline number 6.
Read the other missives only if and when you meet their requirements. I have left other instructions in case of new circumstances. Ianthe holds 24 of these letters and will give you 22, including this one. They are numbered accordingly. Memorize the requirements and carry the letters on you at all times, ready to act the moment you are required to read them. Follow their instructions without hesitation. I repeat, do not read them otherwise. To myself, a brief break in guidelines follows, before the last. You will think at this point that I have given you a terrible hand to play the game with. I am not unsympathetic. Nonetheless, understand that I envy you more than I have ever envied anyone, and that I look upon your birth as a blessing. Look upon me as a Harrowhark who was handed the first genuine choice of our lives, the only choice ever given where we had free will to say no, and free will to say yes. Accept that in this instance, I have chosen to say no.
Guideline number 7.
Examine Ianthe's jaw and tongue after you read this. Owing to her literal status, this will require physical touch. Under no circumstances can you let her know you are examining them. Do whatever it takes. If you suspect either jaw or tongue has been replaced, do not swear the oath. Instead, kill her immediately. In the hope of a future forgiveness, I remained Harrowhark Nonagesimus. Come here, you said, less steadily than you would have liked. Ianthe, still dreamily doused in starlight, obliged you instantly, still smiling that same secret conspiratorial smile, like a spider tucked inside a shoe. She arranged herself in the chair by the bed, and you noticed again her favouring the left arm, as though the right was too heavy a burden. You swung your legs off the hospital cot, and you took the sheeting away from your face, despising your nakedness. Her mismatched eyes widened just briefly as you stood before her, considering. The sword was 6 feet of abandoned steel, tangled in the thin blankets. But you thought that for now, a small distance would have to do, and you reached out to cup Ianthe's face in your hands. Your thumbs pressed up against the warm flesh that skinned her ramus, and your other fingers butterflied over her cheeks. Your metacarpus nudged up against the body of the mandible. When you tilted her jaw up to you, your skin was discoloured against her skin. Her skin was discoloured against your skin. There was the faintest suggestion of dried blood beneath your fingernails. You found your mouth, and eyes screwing up as though against the light or a sour taste, you could not help it. But the vile course of action was obvious. You leant down and, holy shit, kissed her squarely on the mouth.
This, at least, she hadn't expected. How could she? What the fuck? And her mouth froze against yours, which gave you time to work. Ianthe was a black hole to you, a null, an empty, over-radiant space, unreadable. But close physical proximity could echolocate that darkness. It was osteoids your fingers searched for. New bone always gave itself away, its fresh collagen spongy and bright with phallogy. The lining of her cells was in keeping with old bone. When you pressed the tip of your tongue to her tongue, she made a small, tight, half-wounded sound. She was probably trying to call for help. But although the lingual muscle was not your area of specialty, you could probe through flesh the signs that her foramen bone was whole, unscarred by a fresh rip of the tongue from the mouth. You were safe. You withdrew, finally, your mouth from her mouth. Ianthe was left, lips slightly parted, eyebrows raised, her bloodless face untouched by maidenly blushes.
I pledge myself again to the service of Ianthe Tridentarius, Princess of Ida, daughter of the Third House, you said. I swear again to honour any previous agreements I made to her. I swear by my mother, by the salt water, by that which lies dead and unbreathing in the tomb, by the ripped and remade soul of Ortus Nigenad.
Who? She said.
Oh, yes, the cavalier.
Ianthe wiped the pad of her thumb over the blanched bow of her lips, then considered her fingers.
Well, she said eventually, that constitutes some improvement over your sewing my lips shut like you did the...
No, pardon me. I agreed not to mention incidental detail.
Wait, you submitted to be made a sewn tongue?
Ask me no questions, and I shall tell you no lies, said the Princess of Ida, wiping her thumb against her bottom lip again, very delicately.
Look, all I shall say is that for a house that trades solely in bone, you own some enormous needles. I accept your fealty again, Ninth House, and can only assume that you have now read the agreement.
You sat back down on the bed and placed your hand on the sword, which had the effect it always did. Your esophagus gave a little exhausted shiver, your salivary glands jolted, and the nausea rose up behind your eyeballs.
You have wrung a great deal of blood from what seems to be a very little stone, you said.
I gave you something you cared about very deeply at the time, she said, idly swinging one leg to perch over one knee. I don't consider my price all that high, and neither did you. What's more, now we are about to embark on what promises to be a truly beautiful friendship, with me, the lone fruitful thing in your salted field, etc. So I'll thank you to not embark on the I've been hard done by act. Your fingers pressed down hard on the wide breadth of steel. The thundering in your ears was a patchwork of sound and adrenaline, and your heart was sore.
The pledge did not condone disrespect, you said. I will not suckle at your boot heel.
Unnecessarily descriptive, said Ianthe.
I will not suffer insult. I am the Reverend Daughter. I am a lictor. I am in your debt, but I am not here for your amusement.
Not in that thing, you're not, certainly, said Ianthe, whose lip was curling. You look like a huge peppermint. Take this, and this. This, as Ianthe reached suddenly beneath her chair, right arm still strangely flopsome, proved to be a great shiny wadded-up bundle. She tossed it lightly at you. You didn't even try to catch it, and it landed in a lovely pool on the bed. It was a mass of the same thin and frivolous material that currently shrouded Ianthe, a robe in mother-of-pearl colours, all its wrinkles and creases disappearing as you tentatively shook it out. It had a hood. It had deep sleeves, That was all you needed. The colour was not going to become you, but it was hugely preferable to the turquoise shift. You squirmed inside it with unseemly haste. You pulled the hood deep over your head and did not bother to hide your sigh of relief. You were clad from the arms down to the legs, if not modestly. The whole rest of your face was on show. And this was a neat stack of flimsy envelopes, the same as the first. The Harrowhark who had addressed them had taken the time to write their labels, apart from the numbers, in neat crypt script. You flicked through them to count, and could not help scanning the requirements. Some of them were plain and stark. To open in the event of the Emperor's death. To open in the event of Ianthe's death. To open if the Ninth House is in mortal danger. Some of them were opaque to the point of madness. To open if your eyes change. If met, to give to Camilla Hecht. You wondered, mystified, if you had ever known the last name of Camilla the Sixth, a woman you could not recall interacting with at any point. "I will remain in possession of the last two," said Ianthe, having risen to stand. It was always difficult when she stood. She looked so completely like a shoddy wax cast of some more beautiful sculpture. "I will tell you openly that there's one I get to open in case you die, which is fun." You flipped through. Your eyes fell on, "To open if you meet Coronabeth Tridentarius." This was different from the other envelopes, in that it was not written in cipher. You were not happy at the idea that Ianthe had spent any time with your code, and thought your past self complacent in the extreme. Ianthe's eyes fell on it too. "You wrote that one in front of me," she said. "I can summarize the contents. You are now pledged to me, and by extension to Coronabeth, and I tell you for free that one of the riders is that you will never harm a hair on my sister's head." "Your sister is likely no longer alive," you said, seeing no reason not to say it. She threw back her pale head and laughed outright. "Corona," she said when she was done. "My sweet baby Corona is far too stupid to die. She'd walk backward out of the river, swearing blind she was going in the right direction. I will tell you when my sister is dead, thank you, Harrowhark, and that day is not today." Your head was swimming. In a way, you were relieved. Part of you was afraid that this was just another complex part of the hallucination, that you would wake up again, and soon, back in a world where you were not part of your own master plan, a plan you resented, as you resented any peremptory order and any attempt to keep things secret from you, but a plan that nonetheless existed. You could follow any blind precept if the alternative was madness. "If it is all the same to you, I would like to be alone now," you said. "I have a great deal to think about." Ianthe said, "How politely expressed." She drew her skirts around her and curtsied to you. A beautiful, thoughtless movement, prismatic breadths clutched in her fingers, and it was somehow also mockery. When she looked up at you, you saw her eyes had changed yet again. They were both that bleached lavender now, but freckled with light brown like a constellation of little pupils. "Take your time," she said. "I would have thought time was the last thing we had at the moment. But who am I to judge the King Undying, the God of the Nine Houses?" You said, because again you could see no reason not to. "You should have disciplined Turn better, if he's still fighting you this way." Ianthe considered this. She nudged the confection basket hilt of the rapier at her hip aside, and took out a long knife that, again, ran a hot rill of pain down your temporal bone. It was, though you had never bothered to learn, Turn's mangouche, his trident knife, a long blade from which two other blades would spring at the press of some hidden mechanism. She flicked that mechanism now, and with a snicked, they burst out like a firework, two hard points of gleaming steel. She flicked it again, and the blades went snicked back into their housing. She placed her palm before you outstretched. Without a moment's hesitation or sign of pain or even much give, she thrust the knife through the meat of her palm. It must have done enormous damage to flexor muscles, to the nest of carpal bones, and ruby drops of blood splattered the sleeves of her shimmering robe. As she withdrew it, the wound knitted together as though it were nothing. She simply withdrew, and the skin closed up, the meat bounded back on itself, elastic. The whole sizzled to a close, leaving her palm whole and unblemished, except for a few wet drops of crimson red. These she shook off, and they disappeared into powder. For the first time, when you looked at her, Ianthe gleamed with thanagy as a coal gleamed red with heat. "Hold out your hand," she commanded. You did, knowing full well what was to happen. You did it with